So I just wondered if there were comments or questions from the floor. Anyone at all in the room, please just indicate, and please also just say your name. Absolutely, all your comments before you start. So do we have questions, comments? Would anybody like to sing? Okay, go ahead. Please say hello.
Afternoon, everyone. I'm Nikki Steyn. I work in an organization called Section 27 in South Africa. One of the things that we've seen in South Africa, and specifically our teachers and the code of ethics with which they're expected to comply, is we work a lot with sexual violence in schools. And one of the big effects of a successful dismissal of a teacher for rape or sexual assault of a learner is that that teacher will often move on to the private sector because it's very unregulated. The professional body has very little control over the kinds of teachers that are employed in private schools. And often the low-cost private schools in particular don't do thorough background checks on these teachers. So maybe just to get thoughts, if there's some kind of strategy, it's something we've tried to discuss with the teacher unions in South Africa. Not successfully to date. But if you have any thoughts, that would be great.
Thank you, Nikki. Let's take one or two more questions if there are. Please go.
Thank you. I'm Adeline. I work for the Quakey United Nations Office here in Geneva. Thank you, everybody, for your really interesting presentations. My question is about something that we haven't spoken about so far, but within the Quakers, we're interested in the interlinks or the interactions between the education system, whether private or public, and the military. And we're looking in particular at what place the military has in education in relation to the content and purpose of education. So without diverting too much away from the question of privatization, I was wondering whether any of the speakers had come across this in their own work. Perhaps they haven't, but it's if anyone had any comments on this in relation to the privatization of education and the military.
Thank you very much. And then there was one other question. And then there will be one.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Binyam is my name. I am from the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child. Almost all the points that were raised from this are issues that we grapple with on a regular basis from one state party to another state party. Be it from Europe, South America, Asia, Africa. I also work with the African Union as chair of the African Committee of Experts on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. And in fact, next week is June 16, which is the Day of the African Child. And the specific theme is on quality-free education for all children in Africa. Now, that as a backdrop, I know that Morocco is coming up for review this coming September, and obviously one of the issues that the committee will spend a significant amount of time is discussing some of the issues that were raised in relation to Morocco, particularly the privatization issue. So I just wanted to mention those points. Thank you very much. On sexual violence, and I can speak maybe for some parts of Africa, even the concept of what is called sexually transmitted grace, which is a mouthful, disgusting, but reality on the ground is another issue where teachers and students actually involved in sexual relations, particularly for the purpose of grace. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. So we have three questions. One pretty much an input. The first one on control and oversight of teachers and those employed, that there would possibly call a more regulated system into a system where there's less scrutiny and regulation. Any comments on that? The second one, the role of the military in private schools. June 16, South Africa, I'm South African. That was the start of the Soweto riots, but I taught in a black school under apartheid, and we had two South African soldiers teaching in schools, but every black school at the time did have South African, white South African soldiers teaching there. Not linked to privatization, but linked to power, domination, control. I don't think entirely separate issues in the end. And then the question, of course, of sexual violence, which both addressed. So any comments and thoughts, I think, from the panel on those issues, or in fact, anyone else would like to come back on those?
Responding to the question on sexual violence, I think many of our members have developed code of professional ethics to which teachers must comply. Of course, sexual violence is something that we definitely condemn of starting within schools. Our members do provide trainings to teachers against the use of any form of violence against students, whether that's physical or sexual, that this is not a way of disciplining students within the classroom, of course. And the practice where the idea that teachers who are then dismissed from public schools for sexual violations and then entering into private schools is actually something that should be discussed in the area of regulating private schools. States have the obligation to provide minimum regulations and standards on quality within all schools, regardless of whether they're public or private. And this also means, in terms of teachers, that there should be proper screening and rigorous recruitment of teachers processes that are being hired into schools. That includes if teachers do have a record of sexual violence, that is certainly taken into account on whether or not to recruit this teacher. I think we should probably have a conversation afterwards about specifically about the case of South Africa and what unions have been not or have not been doing, but that is certainly UNI's position on this.
Angela?
On the military thing, the two issues with the role of the military, only one of them really directly applies to the issue of privatization. But within India, there is, as I mentioned earlier, there is a provision under the Right to Education Act of reserving 25 seats for the poor. The Indian Army runs a separate set of schools, which are army schools. They have requested and been granted exemption from the provision. Therefore, continues to fail to provide for the poor in its schools. The other part, of course, as with lots of other countries, is the issue of conflict. And therefore, military occupation of the government schools. And therefore, in lots of cases, in places where there are displaced communities operating in camps, private players moving in to provide delivery in a vacuum.
Thanks, Angela. Sylvana, I wonder if you had one or two remarks, I think, on the role of the state's human rights obligations. It might be in answer to these questions, but some of the others might be an idea just to think about it.
Yes, because I concluded earlier, and we've talked a lot about what the issues and the impacts are for the children. Mr. Singh already talked about it. I just wanted to sum up a bit of also what our research has shown. I've tried to map the obligations, the human rights obligations of states relating to privatization. The first key obligation that is essential to note and that Mr. Singh highlighted very much is that states must develop a system of quality education for all. This is fairly clear in treaty, even more clear in the comments that have accompanied it. If you also read the travel repertoire and all documents related to the drafting of the various convention, you see that drafters and states have in mind that education must be public and provided by public providers. This said, it doesn't mean there cannot be private education. In fact, parents have the liberty, not the right, but they must be given the liberty to choose a state, a school other than a state school. Second point. Last point. Although parents can choose a school other than the public school, those private schools must conform to some clear standards that are set up by the state, and the enforcement of these standards by private schools must be monitored. So those are the basic principles. So private education is not forbidden, it's possible as an alternative to public school, which is very different from taking over the system. More specifically, what does it mean? Just coming back to the 5 points I highlighted earlier of the potential impact, well, the related state obligations. In terms of structural discrimination, if we demonstrate that the increase of private education lead to some discriminations, there's a very clear obligation of the state on that, and a very advanced and detailed one, which is the state must do everything it can to avoid discrimination, any sort of discrimination, direct, indirect, on any grounds, should it be social status, or gender, or disability. So if the privatization of education leads to an increasing of discrimination, this is, of course, a violation. There's a clear obligation there. In terms of parents' freedom to support, parents' freedom. So again, we saw that, as explained earlier, the conventions make it clear that we don't forbid private education. Parents must be given the choice if they want to, if they prefer, for various reasons, to go to private school. But it means that there needs to be a public school. For parents who have the choice, they need to have a public school for this reason. If there's no public school of decent quality that is acceptable, there's no such freedom to go to private school. It's an obligation. This is exactly what we saw in Morocco, what we see in many other places. Where there's no freedom to go to private school, there's no obligation for parents. Again, quite clear obligation there. I mentioned there's a, what was the third point earlier, state have a very clear obligation also to regulate private schools in terms of the curriculum, in terms of how they're organized, in terms of how, which kind of students they take, etc., etc. There are limitations, but overall, private schools must conform to some norms set by the state and accepted by all democratically. Another important point is how are these privatization policies decided? We often overlook that. In many places, privatization takes place anyway, as a fact. But this totally disregards the fundamental human rights principle that goes across all human rights. That has, it's not specific to education, it's not specific even to economic social rights, which is everyone has a right to participation. And when you make such fundamental decisions that will reshape the system, your public education system for the next 40 or 50 years, this is something where there needs to be some participation, some informed participation and open debate, open to everyone. You cannot decide, okay, we're going to have, no, all the education system is being privatized, it's going to run totally differently from what it used to be, just behind a closed door. And last point, and this one's probably the most controversial one, but I think we would argue also that states, and I think also Mr. Singh highlighted it very well, have to preserve education as a common good. The predecessor also of Mr. Singh and Katarzyna Chomaszewski, the first report on the right to education, highlighted it a lot too. Education has a special status. It's not like any other good. For instance, it's one of the rare aspects that is not part of free trade agreements. There's a reason for that. Is that it's not like sending a table. When you say education has a role for forming citizenship, it has a role in creating a democracy. It's fundamental. It's the mother of many other rights. Because what is the right to public participation without the right to education? So whatever happens, the state must ensure that this is preserved. And if education becomes, again, if we can show that privatization leads to education becoming a good, a commodity that is exchanged with some relationship between a client and a seller, I think we would argue, and there's strong arguments to make, that this is, again, a violation of an obligation of the state.
Could we take a few more questions now, and then some of the other panelists would come back? Let's see if there's a question, and then we'll come back. Dimitri.
Thanks. My name is Dimitri Holtzman. I'm from the Equal Education Law Center in South Africa. I actually just wanted to pick up on Sylvain's point and to ask a question to perhaps any of the panelists around what you see as key points of advocacy, particularly to address the issue that Sylvain's just ended off with, which is that one of the key principles that we're talking about here is the fact that education is, in fact, a public good. But that in itself is a tension with Sylvain's other point, which is that we cannot prohibit the provision of education through private institutions. So while that is a possibility on the one hand, I think that there is, as you were saying, some responsibility for the state, based on its obligations, to obey the increasing privatization of education. So I guess my question is, from an advocacy and rights perspective, what do you see as the key areas which for human rights advocates, particularly working outside of the state, and perhaps even from the state's perspective? For example, we mentioned in legislation in India where there's a protection of a quota system for private schools taking a certain amount of students from poor areas, for example. That in itself is quite an interesting middle point between this tension where the state is saying, look, on the one hand, you actually have to preserve these places and in essence legitimizing the privatization of education on the one hand, but at the same time has these conflicting obligations to, in fact, try and reduce and not, in fact, lay the path for an increase in privatization. I think for me that's an issue which, from a public advocate's perspective, is something that I'd like to just get some reflection on.
Thanks, Dimitri. Another one or two questions, perhaps? Yes.
Hi, I'm Tony Baker from Results Educational Fund. I want to build on that, a similar question on just where those interventions and advocacy are. But first, just a few comments. I really appreciate everyone's presentations. I really loved how Mr. Singh, you opened and framed this appropriately as far as questions on economic status and discrimination. Arisema, I really appreciated the violations that you listed and put those into the 4A framework. It really just resonated with me and helped me see more clearly the violations that we're discussing. And I also enjoy the example that I was thinking of in terms of deprofessionalization of education. And I know Bridge Academies was mentioned a couple of times, but that's always one. It's hard for me to imagine education in a classroom that is like that, where a teacher is just delivered a script every morning of what they're to say in a classroom, and their role has been completely disempowered to simply be reading out what is to be taught in that day. So thank you for all of those interventions. But the question of the points for advocacy, and I think, Tony, you were the first to bring this up with kind of mapping out the players in the landscape. And while the clear obligations lie on the state, and that's first and foremost the key point for intervention, donors and what development banks and what bilateral agencies are doing are also part of that. And I was curious as to anyone's thoughts of either what they've seen more in the field from that, the types of activities that donors are driving, and then any thoughts on how to address that, given obligations really do lie in the state and there's power to access and build those arguments. But if a lot of this activity is being driven from outside, from different donor agencies, how to address that? And an example, I'm from Washington, and we watch closely what USAID is doing. And I think, as mentioned in the beginning, how their positions are very clear. And again, in April at the Lahore University of Management Sciences, USAID put together a 250 participant, two-day conference called Harnessing the Power of Low-Cost Private Schools. So it's very clear, those actions are very strongly taken out there. So if there's any thoughts from anyone on the panel as ways to address that side of the issue. Thank you.
Thanks very much for those two questions and one short. Okay, there's three more coming. Can we keep them quite short and then we'll try to respond to Mari? Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Marie Sanya and I am with ANSEFA. I have, again, still building on advocacy and strategies, particularly to call attention to this topic. I wanted to also hear Brazil's experience, because in terms of quotation, we have a long experience, especially with post-secondary for Black Brazilians. So I wanted to know, in terms of privatization in the public education, primarily, I don't know if there's any initiatives on that movement. And also, it's funny because you hear your voice trembling and then you're like, okay, what's going on? but also for the donors' perspective on advocacy planning, I'm also interested here on us brainstorming on having this creating possibilities where we're advocating for the true cause as opposed to the donors' agenda, especially for World Bank right now, where their strategy is along the lines of privatization. So how do we keep this thin line, in a sense, between what the donors would actually like for us to advocate and as opposed to what we really need to advocate, but then might be strangled with the funds for it?
Thanks very much. I'm glad I didn't have to use this some time today.
I'll try and be completely out of order so that you can. My name is Ian Ferson. I'm with the Open Society Foundations. I wanted to pick up on a point raised by Mr. Singh and then picked up again or repeated by Sylvain, which is on state obligations and the importance of a minimum set of standards for private schools. On the obligations on the part of the states to provide those, and really to problematize that, and to kind of highlight the difference between kind of normative ideal and the reality, particularly with regard to low-fee private schools. It's clear that in some contexts there are no minimum standards for private schools. Okay, so that is clearly a moving obligation that the state can make. In other contexts, there are minimum standards for private schools, and many low-fee private schools are simply unable to match them. Are unable to meet them. So what you have is a phenomenon of unrecognized and unregistered low-fee private schools, which can form a significant percentage of private provision. In such cases, what then happens with regards to the role of the state and the role of implementing this minimum standards? Because if I'm not mistaken, in Pakistan, it has been decreed that those low-fee private schools that do not meet and minimum standards must be closed. However, none of the schools have been closed because there is no alternative for those pupils. So you have a bit of an impasse, and I'd be really interested to hear from Mr. Singh and from Sylvain and other panelists on how do you deal with the dissonance, if you will, between a normative position and a reality.
Thank you very much, Ian. We have one more question, and our brilliant panel will solve all those questions for us really quickly. Thank you very much.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Thea Soriano. I'm from the Asian South Pacific Association for Basic and Adult Education. Why is privatization of education a violation of human rights? This has been one of the questions that were raised when we are doing advocacy, because the idea is that the private sector has always been there in providing education. But what we have seen in the past 15 years, there is also an increased demand in education. And member states, in their effort to fulfill education for all, they build all these schools, but there is admittedly a need for them to invest more on quality. But what we have to expose is also that instead of helping member states strengthen public education system, there are efforts by funding agencies or multilateral banks to provide them, let's say, an option. For example, countries that are in transition, like Nepal and even Myanmar now, are being offered these packages of more private sector participation in education instead of helping public education system. So I think there's also that accountability for multilateral banks. No? And even countries with very good public systems are at the threat of being privatized because they are offering these packages as well. So I think this trend of privatization not only state obligation on the one hand, but also the accountability of multilateral banks and how they are destroying the public education system worldwide.
Thanks very much. So, those are big questions. They're interlinked in some way. It's part of all the donors, part of the importance of messages for advocacy, specific vectors for how certain communities such as Black Muslims. And I think in this point, part of the standards and the work for private schools being a preferred policy option, yet not actually meeting even the state's minimum standards in a number of other states and other places. So, any responses from anyone in the panel?
Well.
Anyone else?
I would like to address the, especially Dimitri's and Tony's points on advocacy. And I think that from the point of view of advocacy, what we need to do is to challenge the new common sense that is constructed around the desirability of low-fee private schools. I think that we need to demonstrate that low-fee private schools are not a virtue of the system. They are the result of the weak commitment of the state with the right to education. I think that this is the narrative that we need to push forward. And we need to look at what are these weaknesses in state education, in public education, because it doesn't mean that we are, the fact that we are critical with privatization doesn't mean that we like the public system as it is, and I think that this is very important. So, what are the good research telling about low-fee private schools? They are basically saying that it's not like James Tully, that the poor are choosing low-fee private schools because they are better. No. Most of the times, the poor go to low-fee private schools because there is no a public alternative nearby, or the poor people is living in slums that sometimes they are not even in the urban planning of government. So the state schools are not there because the state doesn't know that people is living there. So this is one of the problems. Sometimes public schools are there, but they are not well managed. We also need to say that. And sometimes these public schools are not inclusive enough. And some poor people, as I say, from some minorities, they don't feel recognized in the official curriculum. So this is something, these 3 points, I think that is something that from the advocacy point of view, we also need to address. And concerning Tony's question on what are the donors doing, I think that what they are doing is basically giving financial support to these initiatives, as I think that traditionally USAID, the FID, most European aid agencies, they try to reinforce the public sector, and now they have this two-track strategy, and somehow they are doing the bypass to the public sector because they consider again that the low-fee private school is a virtue. But when they do that, and especially I think that we need to highlight one of the paradoxes of the low-fee private schools advocates like James Tully, that they come from a libertarian tradition, that they consider that the market is the solution to everything, that the state is always a problem. Because somehow they were saying that the market will solve everything, but now, especially after they have organized their own schools, they are going to the state, they are going to the donors, asking for public money to support these schools. So I think that you also need to highlight this type of weaknesses and paradoxes.
Thank you, Tony. We have about 5 minutes left, but I am going to ask Ira and Angela to come in really quickly on some of the points that you had possibly respond to. It's the great sum of the policy and recommendations and recommendations.
Thank you. About the question of points for advocating, I'm speaking from a Brazilian perspective where our experience is to advocate for public sufficient funding for education system. And based on a minimum pattern of education, for example, related to infrastructure of schools, which goes directly to dignity of human beings. And for that, we need to dispute the meaning of what we understand for quality of education. We have some experience that we can exchange later, we don't have much time, and about what Maris asked. In 2012, the Brazilian Parliament approved a law for social and racial quotas in universities. And it was a victory of social movements, black movements, and we can share a bit more later. Thank you.
two bits. One is the roadmap will be different depending on how what share of the size of provisioning is by the private sector. If it is largely currently public provisioning with a smaller private sector, recognize first of all that corporate education reform has not delivered on the promises, which means they are not delivering high quality and cost saving. They are not fostering inclusion, they are fostering exclusion. Recognize it and have a strategy to disseminate that finding so that it is persuasive. Support public sector, which is the main provider. Often the government itself lacks faith in its own provision. Therefore, have faith in it, foster it, give it the funds that the public sector requires to deliver, and not push for untested, proven to fail alternatives in the name of innovation. Sometimes you don't need to innovate. Sometimes you need to do what has been proven to work. Yes, may at times be the short route of accountability through parent-teacher associations, SMCs, as a replacement to accountability through fees. Do not subsidize private provisioning. However, where private provisions do exist, then there are certain sets of measures that need to be put in place. As people have said, there needs to be a set of charters of minimum standards that apply to what. Problem is, and the since Ian mentioned Pakistan, it has come from India because the Pakistan's legislation is in lots of ways a copy of India's. The problem is when we assume that having a legislation will automatically bring changes on the ground. A law or any policy needs to be backed by a plan of action, how to roll it out. It needs to be backed with a process of awareness about those entitlements, both on the part of parents and private providers, and hello, often even government officials who don't know how it is to be rolled out. Transparency measures are needed in private schools, or public-private partnership, which is both financial and normative. By which I mean stuff like contracts and stuff like what are actually people delivering. There has to be measures for whistleblower protection, etc., so that people are actually able to come up with the evidence that's required. Monitoring mechanisms on the part of the state. Therefore, if you have a mechanism, then only will you be able to deliver on ensuring effective regulation. Yes, there needs to be a mechanism to counteract the pro-private discourse by donors. A, we cannot no longer ignore the fact that it is happening. We need to package our evidence better. We need to have a strategy for advocacy which includes a strong element of north-south sharing.
Wow, thank you very much. We do have to close at 2, but I'm going to ask Kishore to speak for 30 seconds to close the meeting, and I'll be watching him.